Wow, guys, we got a lot of people in here. Excited to talk with Ray Mazzi for the seventh episode, seventh opportunity we've had to do your Build Your Legacy series. Probably got a lot of Build to Rent guys in the room. So welcome, everybody. We're going to be partying down with Ray Mazzi and Andy McMullen, who Andy is at the Build to Rent IMN event in Las Vegas, hanging out with Neil Bawa and all these cool guys in the Build to Rent space. But welcome, everybody. Let us know in the chat real quick if you'd like to learn how to build 1,600 units at the age of 29 or older in the chat by giving us a one. And also let us know if you've done any build to rent, whether that's just a couple houses that you've rented or if you've done subdivisions like my man, Andy McMullen. But we're going to go ahead and get started. Yeah. We got Ray Mazzi on. Give us a little bit about your background, man. How did you get started and build such a portfolio?
No problem. I just got back from that IMN conference too. But so basically, real quickly, I graduated law school and business school about a little bit over, I think it was right around 4 years ago. I came down to South Florida after working in Governor Scott's office and working as an attorney on the real estate and tax side for about a year or so. Worked at Governor Scott for about a year and then came down to South Florida to work for my now business partner. And after my equity vested at that startup, we became really good friends during that 18-month period. And about 2.5 years ago, June of 2020, we started Southern Waters Capital. And from there, we kind of just dove right in. We're both attorneys by education, but certainly not an attorney I would hire for any of my legal issues or anything like that. But we know just enough to be dangerous. And we went around the state of Florida tying up a bunch of dirt. And I've been lucky enough to have an entitled pipeline of just over 1,600 units now, with a good bit of them going into construction. You know, everything's caveated with depending upon how the market is, but should be going into construction of Q1 in 2023. So super excited about that. I'm kind of new to the industry, just like everybody else, except for the next metros of the world and people who have been doing it for 10, 11 years before it was, you know, hip to Wall Street. But that's me in a nutshell, and excited to be here. And thank you for the opportunity, Ruben.
Yeah, man. Stoked to have you on here. And we're going to be releasing a podcast with you in a couple of weeks too. So that should be fun. Andy, break down a little bit about your BTR and development background, my friend.
Yeah, so I've been in it a little bit longer than Ray. Actually, I'd love to mark up maybe a question about his takeaways, because I'm certainly got a lot of thoughts about the BTR conference. But I've been doing this about 20 years, kind of started on the brokerage side, then multifamily, some development in live workspace in California. And then we've really been kind of digging in on, you know, built to rent in the Southeast, where we feel like we can, you know, build inexpensively enough with municipalities that really want us there and support us. We've got a great team there. Right now we've got about, 600 units underway. So either in the development phase, I'm saying either in the development phase right now or entitling. So yeah, you're probably right. It's probably more than that. But yeah, I'm excited to kind of talk a little bit about what we've been doing and where, you know, where we see this going.
And I'm Ruben. I've been hanging out with Andy McMullen for a little over a year now, had never developed anything. And now we have 100 unit plus 154 plus a 220 plus a 240 all in the pipeline or already under development. So this has been a crazy wild ride trying to learn this whole thing on the fly and get people educated in this space. It's a phenomenal space that's seen a lot of profit and it's very lucrative. When everybody else is struggling to find deals, we have the ability to create and design our own destiny, which is a lot of fun, man. But so maybe we could start a little bit, you know, I'm going to run down some topics that we're going to cover, market selection, because I don't think build to rent is the same in Phoenix as it is in Florida, as it is in Alabama, as it is in Portland. We're going to be talking about the different phases of construction, maybe what those are called. Capital raising for build to rent, which is a little bit of a different risk profile and play than for multifamily development, which a lot of my audience is kind of used to raising for. Understanding the different time frames of development, utilizing different exit strategies, You can force appreciation at every stage along the way. So this is going to be fun. But let's start out with what you guys have been learning and what you guys have been doing out in Las Vegas, man. What is Neil Bawa saying about Built to Rent these days, guys?
I'll let Andy go first. Admittedly, I don't think I made it to one session except for Jeff Klein's speech. So I was there to meet with a bunch of people. But Andy, please tell me what you learned and I'll see if I can fill in some holes.
Yeah, you know what's interesting about this conference is it's one of the few conferences that I've been to where almost everybody on stage did not have a dogmatic opinion. Usually you're brought there to have a take, right? And there was a lot of kind of equivocating. I think the overall consensus generally is that of all the asset classes, built to rent benefits from the trifecta, right? Which is it's got rents that are increasing. It's got affordability now that, you know, is really almost $750 above, you know, where we'd be paying for a mortgage, which is a pretty large disparity, right? Which would kind of bode well for, you know, not a whole lot of people buying in the areas that we're building. And then, you know, I think that you've got basically just lack of supply in most of these markets. Now, before 2008, Ruben, I remember real estate being a lot more localized. So you'd have kind of this ascension in some markets and then, you know, that other markets would be descending. And then after 2008, it just became kind of a global, you know, rates are completely up or they're completely down, or we can get loans or we can't get loans. So I think we're getting a lot more back to that kind of localized real estate where you can kind of pick markets that make sense. And I think you've got to have obviously a little bit more conservative, you know, underwriting than even before. But I think that's kind of what my takeaways were.
I don't know if I heard this at the conference, but I'm sure you did in your talkings with other people. But you know, you just hear the kind of pencils down mentality on secondary and tertiary markets, and people may, at least from the equity side, and people may define a secondary and tertiary market in different ways. So setting that aside, there's certainly, in my opinion, some apprehension and hesitation, or at least, you know, waiting on the sideline for the markets that, quite frankly, I prefer. So it's one of those things where it's been interesting for me to kind of try and bring people into these markets in the face of all these headwinds. And it's just funny how the investor profile has changed, but there's still plenty of liquidity out there. There's still plenty of debt going around. You just have to have the right basis and the right location and the right product, and you can make it happen.
Yeah. You know, one thing that I've kind of learned, Ray, over this last maybe 2 months is there's still a lot of money out there. They're still doing loans. They're still doing deals. The terms are probably a little bit more in their favor. Obviously, if you've got, you know, if you've got SOFR at 250, kind of, I think it was at 280 a couple of weeks ago, you know, then obviously there's going to be a little bit more terms. We've got a great lender in Arbor on our projects. There's a lot of other guys that are still in that kind of second tranche, you know, mezzanine or kind of private equity guys that are still lending. They just might want a little more collateral. So there's still things happening. Mm. I still feel like the opportunity to get deals done in the built to rent space is there. And I even talking to the guys in the multifamily is a little tougher, right? Because you don't have that spread that you did. So, you know, our investors have got to really take a ride with you on a 70, 80 build when they're not getting, you know, any cash flow probably for 12 to 24 months. So that's a different kind of investor. But I think in the built to rent space, we still have a lot of people really bullish on it.
Yeah, no, I would totally agree. And hats off to Arbor and Lumit. They're always the first debt groups I go to see where the market's at. I like the guys and gals over there. I'd agree with you. Really what's happening now, it all the stories of people who had assets in 08 and 09 who were current on their payments, but all of a sudden woke up one day and they were under collateralized and their notes got called. That's kind of stuff that a young guy like me leans on. You know, my business partner is 25 years my senior, you know, had a 30-year run on Wall Street. So he has the war stories and scars from those days. And, you know, for us, it's just being super, super careful when you do get somebody to commit capital, whether it's debt or equity, that everybody knows there's a situation or scenario where the market could shift and people need to recapitalize or however you want to handle that issue, according to your firm. But yeah, no, those are the stories and murmurings I'm hearing. I'm certainly not slowing down. As things get worse, my projects honestly have started to look better, only relative to other projects, obviously not relative to the pro forma 6 months ago of its own, but that's kind of how we see the market.
No, and just one thing I would add is for people here that are interested in built to rent is that I do think that there's a real market now for community banks. whatever market that you're working in, that money is still available. That money is still competitive. And usually with kind of actually breaking them down, you know, after a while, you can create some kind of programmatic relationships in those areas. So I would lean into that source as well. Go ahead, Ruben.
Yeah, I just wanted to go dive into market selection, right? So we are selecting properties in Louisiana and in Alabama where the properties are pretty flat. There's no grading of mountainous, you know, kind of hilly terrain or whatnot. You can't typically go into Phoenix and do, you know, smaller syndications in the built-to-rent space when you're competing with these massive institutions that can hold, you know, their money in deals from the day that you start entitling and go through all the red tape that takes 3 years. You know, us as syndicators in the built-to-rent space, we need to get our investor money back quickly. So one of the things that we do is we don't accept money until it's time to start syndicating and the land is shovel ready, infrastructure is in place. Typically, if we're going to raise at that phase and not prior to that phase so that we can get our investor money back as fast as possible. But why don't you guys talk a little bit about why Florida, why Louisiana, why not in Phoenix, why not in California or somewhere else?
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to start that one because I'm absolutely in love with the state of Florida. So first and foremost, I mean, I was happy 6-7 months ago to buy anywhere in the Sun Belt, just like a lot of other people. I mean, I'm not saying that the Sun Belt is bad now, but what I am saying is that the migration patterns coming to Florida, it's just very obvious. You don't have to be an intelligent person to see that if you've got low supply and an insane amount of migration and what I would call a favorable government, then you have a recipe for at least opportunity at the very least. And I would say for success for anybody with good skills and a good team. So for us, it's really simple. Aside from the YIMBYism in Florida, the yes in my backyard type of attitude. In addition to that, you just have a great economy. You've got great fundamentals when you look at the supply and demand, like I said. And lastly, there's still value here. You know, as long as you're not buying on the coast or in Tampa or in Orlando or in the Tri-County, and you just go a little bit further out, 20, 30, 40 minutes away, where your supply and demand imbalance is even greater and your rent growth is just as strong. Granted, it might be lower on a per square foot, but if you're in the right areas that aren't wind zones and things like that, you can make up for that differential and loss of efficiency. So for me, it's just it's like a playground. It's unbelievable. I think there's absolutely tons of opportunity. And what people, you know, people are always blown away by, we buy unentitled dirt. You know, that's what we go after. So our basis is blended always below $10,000 a lot, a blank lot. So I don't, you know, I'm a guy that all I care about is my basis and my location. And I think I have my best chance of finding those two things in the state of Florida. Texas to me is the second bastion along with Tennessee, but Texas is just so big. It's not my playground. I don't know enough about it. I feel like I can miss a lot easier in a big state. And then when it comes to Tennessee, the mountains, like you just mentioned, I'm a Florida boy. I have no idea about mountain issues, things like that. I understand flood zones and wind zones and environmental issues down here and all the different types of trees and protected species. No, so it's kind of just familiarity, number one. And then I'm just blessed enough to be in a state where I spent 10, 15 years working in government and working with people in trades and things like that. So just well entrenched. We love the economics behind it. And then the government is really, you know, pro building down here. So that's what we see.
Yeah, it's interesting. Each market has its kind of unfair advantage. And so for Ray, you know, he's well entrenched in kind of the politics of the area. He's got, you know, quite a bit of a track record there. I think for us, Ruben, in areas like the Southeast, where we kind of have an unfair advantage there is one, our acquisitions team has been working on deals in that Southeast region with the big players for numbers of years, right? And so having those relationships to find actual lots that make sense. We try to focus, as you know, in areas that we have, you know, low impact fees. We can get the land relatively inexpensively. We really focus again on the relationships. I know I sound like a break the record, but we want to be able to meet with the mayor. We want to be able to hear that they love what we're doing in these areas. And then the other thing that I think people need to kind of consider is, what is the exit strategy for a lot of these areas? So we followed in some of these secondary and tertiary markets where maybe some of the bigger players are going. For instance, in Foley, Alabama, the reason that we kind of found that site was, hey, look, this is where D.R. Horton just bought a property and doubled their money. And if, and they're exiting out of those properties now. And after we've met with the mayor and the city, they don't want any more multifamily projects. They want the clean, you know, the clubhouse and the pool and the trees and the green around the area. So we kind of figure out what is that story that we can latch on to and what will promote getting people there in those units. And usually it's good schools and growth.
Cool. How about we jump into phases of construction and their underlying profitability? In other words, how much can you make at each phase? If you entitle the property, is it worth more? If you put an infrastructure, how much more is it worth? Does it make sense to sell along the way or to keep these things? What happens if you get into an opportunity zone? You want to start with this, Andy?
Yeah, sure. I think as Ray mentioned, you know, we're buying raw land as well. And so where you can really create value immediately, and what we usually do is we'll set up an option with that seller of the land. And I think that's a takeaway, by the way, as an aside, that there is starting to become an adjustment in the land prices, which I think will be more favorable even now, because, you know, land in Phoenix, you know, why some of those areas that we don't want to be buying, you know, if it was at 40,000 an acre, now it's at, you know, whatever it is, 180,000 acre, that those can't pencil, right? So I think land prices are falling, but I think we can option the property, entitle it, and then once we've got it all entitled, we've got the city approval, the county approval, we don't have any more hearings that we need to go and convince people that we are going to build something beautiful in their neighborhood, then we can purchase the land. So as an example, Foley, Alabama, about 20, is it 28 acres, Ruben?
Yeah.
So it's 28 acres. We bought it for, I think, $1 million with, so a 950 for the land, another 100,000 to do engineering and environmental, and that will take us to the horizontal phase. So now at this point, we've created value because it was raw land. Now it's titled land with engineering drawings, with environmental, all that's done. Now we can go to start building out the infrastructure, right? The streets, the utilities, the roads, sewer, et cetera. And in each of those phases, there are developers, lot developers, land developers that might want to just sell that entitled land to the next guy or take it all the way through. So at each one of those phases, there's an opportunity for value creation. So that's kind of at a short, we can elaborate on it more if you think it's worthwhile, but that's kind of, you know, at each phase, there's an opportunity to create more and more value. And we try to, at each phase, mitigate risk, right? If somebody's investing with us at raw land, obviously their risk is much greater than if they're waiting till we've starting the vertical or the unit build after all the infrastructure's in place.
So yeah, actually I have another question to Andy along that. So you entitle the dirt and then you put in infrastructure. Let's say, you know, let's just use some concrete numbers. If the property, you buy it for $1 million, you entitle it, it's going to cost $8 million to develop the infrastructure. What might that property be worth in Louisiana or Alabama after the infrastructure is put in, and how much does it cost to put in that construction?
Yeah. So like for our property in Foley, it's a $32 million project in its whole, right? So if we do the infrastructure at eight, you know, we're going to have another $24 million for unit build and fees and all the rest of it. Now, the value is created by what the market will bear, which I know sounds like a really trite, of course, answer, but really you're looking at comps and you're looking at land prices. So you could basically reverse engineer what was the valuation based on NOI for a development that's close by and what was the cost. Now, here's the thing. Some lenders really only want to give you credit for your own basis, the skin in the game that you have. So, you know, if you brought, you know, land, you put in $500,000 into the deal that we had and we had a bridge loan for the rest. Some lenders are only giving us credit as we go into the horizontal phase for just that amount. But there's others that are specialty lenders. They're starting to become a lot more prevalent, which will give you equity or implied implicit equity for that value that you've created. So let's say that you're raising for a project that's, you know, maybe your total equity's got to be $8 million or something like that. Well, rather than going out to investors on the retail side, now in many cases, you can roll over part of that equity and that value that you've created. So now you don't need to pay that 25 or 24%, whatever that money that you're paying to retail investors. Now you've got some equity that you can carry forward. So I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Ray, or how you guys.
Yeah. I mean, for us, it's simple. So whenever you walk into an asset, like just like you said, we option it. We're not buying it until we have no more type of votes going on or all the approvals that we need in order to feel comfortable. And in a basic sense, usually the builders are going to try and keep their land basis within their project at less than 25% of the total cost per unit. And if you consider that based and juxtapose that against the 20% profit margin they want to make, you can kind of decide if you can bridge the gap and your project works. So, you know, I'm not the best at math. So we just keep it really simple at our shop. We basically say, you know, we're probably never, ever going to pay over $15,000 an unentitled unit unless it's some kind of serious exception, if you will. But other than that, it's pretty simple. If you can stay under the 15K and you're forcing appreciation in a good location, forcing entitlements in a good location, then you should be able to provide an exit to a builder. That's like my last resort exit would be to a builder and selling off lots. And like I said, the math that the builder is going to look at is going to say, hey, I'm building whatever, a $200,000 home, right? So considering that, you know, I can only spend 25% of that $200,000 on the land, and I want to leave a 20% margin for myself at the end. And of course, there's some bend there, and they might only spend, you know, 20% of the land, and then they'll take a smaller margin or vice versa or whatever it is. But that's the general rule of thumb as we look at it from a builder standpoint. That's as basic as I can keep it.
Ray, I'm curious about this, man. At which phase is the most profitable? Is it when you put in infrastructure? Is it worth a lot more after that? Is it?
It depends on who's on the other side of the bid, right? So there's been phases where the most profitable thing to do is literally just flip the project before I even do any entitlements. I haven't honestly had the pleasure of that happening just yet, but there's been times back a year ago where I considered it. People came in really quickly and I put something under contract and they're like, hey, we'll give you $1 million for the contract. And I only put down 25 grand. I've been working on it for 15 days. So obviously that's an insane return. But we didn't hit that bid. It was fine. We moved on and we kept that project. But really, to answer your question with complete honesty, is it truly depends on the other side of the bid and it all comes down to the project. But I think that we can all agree that the most value that's created is through the imputed equity that Andy was referring to in between our cost basis and what you can bring it to an LP at or a co-GP at or a debt partner at. You want to force as much imputed equity and then you roll that into your capital account or however your group decides to do it. And that's where you leverage that equity into a strong position in the vertical build. And I think truly, if you're talking about just dollars, the most dollars are going to be made staying in throughout the entire cycle. If you're talking about percentage, it's probably for a guy like me, who's really a land developer with the desire and ability to go vertical, it's probably going to be right after entitlement if I find an institutional buyer. So it really comes down to what you want. Do you want to build generational wealth and hold on to assets, or do you want to make as much cash as you can and use that to build generational wealth down the road? Everybody has a different situation, but that's kind of how I look at every deal.
Cool. Andy, yesterday on our Coach EP call, you were talking about the golden goose. You want to enlighten us about what you're talking about? Is like why an LP would want to stay in for a longer term versus a shorter term?
Yeah, well, I think Ray hit on it. Is I think there's a lot of investors there, you know, our Legacy Acquisitions is our name, and we were trying to build legacy wealth. I had a really good conversation with Ryan Smith, who does a lot of industrial. You guys might know him at Elevation. He's got probably $750 million under management, but he's got investors that have been investing with him for years, and they would come after his head if he sold any of those properties, right? He's got cash flow that's paying them monthly, and if they've got a capital event now and sell it now, those investors got to pay taxes. So what I was saying yesterday is one of the opportunities that we have is in an opportunity zone where any investor that's coming in would basically stay in for 10 years and then their capital would be returned without any taxes. And so, you know, some investors maybe 3, 4, 5 months ago would say, hey, look, I'd really like to be out of a deal in 3 to 5 years. I want to kind of accelerate my cash into the next thing, trade 1031 forward, et cetera. But my point on that project is, if, like Ray said, we can stabilize the unit with rents and we're paying cash flow. And I think in year 3, 4, or 5, we're at, 14%, AAR, average annual return cash flow, then why would you want to kill that golden goose after 5 years and try to find another property where you're going to get 14%, right? And that you're going to maybe potentially pay taxes on getting out of it. So every project's different. Lafayette, Louisiana is probably going to be a little shorter for us, right? We'll get out after we stabilize and move on to the next project. But more and more as we're growing, I would rather be holding on to assets longer because I think that benefits, there's a difference, Ruben, between, wealth creation and cash flow. It's really hard to create wealth with cash flow, right? Because it's a finite amount, but when you're holding on and you're benefiting from the appreciation of the assets and the depreciation and the tax sheltering and the loan pay down, and you keep rolling that forward at year after year, that's when wealth is created.
Interesting. Any comments on that, Ray?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. And it all comes down to your company's life cycle and your point of view. And really for us, so as a 2.5-year-old company, I actually want velocity of cash flow. I'm happy to cash out as quickly as possible, take the cash and roll it into the next deal. But Andy's completely right. There's not a false portion of Andy's statement. It's just, it all comes down to who you're dealing with. So for instance, my first 250 units that I brought in, I entitled them as quickly as I could. And I put them out to bid for sale and we made a great return. So that's one of those things we were able to capitalize a business, turn around and grab another 1600 units. So it's just one of those things where you kind of really have to understand what you want. And then at the end of the day, it's up to the bigger co-GP. So I'm not the bigger co-GP in most of my deals. I am the sole owner and operator up until I bring in a very large, either very, very wealthy family or a large institution to be our co-GP. And then at that point, they're like, hey, Ray, you run the day-to-day. My job is to force as much yield, basically increase my yield on cost every single day. That's my goal. All I do is try and push the spread between my exit cap rate and my yield on cost. And then my co-GP helps me or tells me when we're going to be selling and what we're going to be doing and all that stuff. That I don't have an ego when it comes around. I certainly have an ego, but I do not have an ego when it comes to when to sell or how long to hold or anything like that. It's a math equation for us. And if my co-GP is happy, they've probably been doing it a lot longer than me, so I'll be happy too. And that's how I look at it. But my job is to increase yield on costs, reduce risk, and make sure that we're ready to exit whenever my partners want to.
That sounds like something that an institution would want.
Hey, yep, Ruben, can I ask Ray, about yield to cost? I think that if you might, just describe to the audience a little bit because I think that that's really a big part of development that people miss.
Yeah, and it's quite amazing because it's literally the only thing you need to understand in order to do a project. Like if you can understand yield on cost, which is nothing but your NOI over your total development cost, it just says, how much money are you making versus how much money you had to spend, whether it's your money, other people's money, debt, equity, blah, blah, blah. How much money are you making over the total development cost? And that spread, that should be at least 200 basis points away from your exit cap rate. If you don't have a 200 basis point spread, you're playing with fire. I mean, you have 75 bips getting pushed up. I would make a bet that we have another 75 basis point hike coming in here soon. And you just see that margin get eaten away and eaten away and eaten away. And the next thing you know, you're standing there and you're like, am I really going to try and do a project where I'm building at a 6? Cap rates are at a 5 right now. But in a year and a half, if things keep going bad, they could easily be up at a 5.5. And now I got 50 basis points of spread. I'm not going to hit any of my waterfalls. I'm just going to basically recoup my capital account, which means I should have just sold the asset a long time ago. That's kind of like the merchant builder thinking. And I like to think like a merchant builder and to think like a long-term holder. So we underwrite everything. My group underwrites everything for 10 years. If you get stuck with the baby and you got to hold it for 10 years, you'll be okay. But the real goal is to get out as quickly as possible at the highest yield before that, so long as you're not doing anything risky to get there. I'm not going to ever increase risk to shorten the timeline. It doesn't make sense if we were all okay holding the asset for a certain period at the beginning. There's no reason to beat a timeline. The only thing you want to do is beat your return thresholds. It's a little bit different when you're constructing. Obviously, you always want to beat a timeline during construction. Anyway, the yield on cost is exactly what an institution, if you start talking to an institution about your IRR and this and that, they're going to be like, all right, well, that stuff all moves based off construction costs and product type and per square foot and unit mix and blah, 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 blah. They're just going to tell you straight up, if they never met you before, what's your yield on cost? Are you over 6.5? If you're not over 6.5, just we'll talk to you when you are. And that's pretty much how I deal with everybody. I catch everybody's attention by saying that here's what you need to know. If you're going to sell a deal to an institution, it's like, do you like the market? Do you like the price? Do you like the site? Do you like the product? Do you like the people? Those are the things. If they say yes to all those things, you got a really great shot at raising the capital. If you can't convince them of those things, don't waste your time on them. Because if you can't convince them on the market, what the hell's the point? I mean, what is the point? So I start out in that order. By the time we get to the people, it's more of how much am I going to bend to do a deal with you? That's pretty much how it is, because there's a huge imbalance in the balance sheets. So for us, that's how we approach everything. And you get their attention with strong yield and you seal the deal with a good location and a good basis.
You got really high energy on that answer. Yeah. That's hilarious. Hey, so let's go into capital raising. So where do you get your money from typically for your projects, Ray?
So the beginning capital, all the pursuit capital in the beginning is Southern Waters. I'm blessed enough to have a business partner, Dean Miro, who's been very successful in his own right. So we're able to pursue projects on our own up into a certain point. Each project, we account for $1 million to $1.5 million for a pre-development cost before you're at a shovel-ready state. But usually what happens is we probably spend about half of that. And by the time we get there, I'm at a site plan stage in the process. And that's when a co-GP really does want to come in. You don't want to build somebody else. And people have different opinions on this. So, you know, take it with a grain of salt. But I don't think you should be building a site plan or planning a site plan unless it's purely conceptual. You shouldn't be submitting anything if you don't know who your co-GP is, because they're going to have specific product specifications. They're going to have specific desires. And the only thing that it's going to do is work against you. Because if I were an institution, I came in and you were one step into the site plan, even if I loved your site plan, I'd tell you how much I hate it, because now I'm going to beat your price up. And that's basically what you do. You go in, we bring the paint, the paintbrushes, the canvas, we set it all up and we say, hey, co-GP, let's draw something together and let's see what we can do. So the beginning pursuit money comes from my business partner and our firm personally. After that, it's all private, honestly, family office money and or sometimes an institution, but really the institution would be a PE firm backed by a big institution. Usually the actual, you know, I'm not talking to Blackstone and people like that. They're not trying to bet on a young kid like me. But if I get a PE firm that has capital from Blackstone, then, you know, two deals down the road, they probably will. So that's how we do it. It's much better what we want is patient capital. If you have a good, I've said it 100 times, but if you have a good site with a good basis and your capital's patient and very, very understanding and gets real estate, then you're going to be okay. So that's what we do. We look for staying power that we can tie to our project that we believe is really great. And we know that, you know, markets may not be the best right now and they may not be the best later on, but we know that our site is the best, our price is really great, and they have enough money to wait for the right time. So that's kind of how we approach it. And then when it comes to LP capital, yeah, most of these co-GPs that I bring in, they have, you know, their buddies. they're usually a piece of the LP as well. And if they put a piece in the LP, then all their friends, and when I say friends, they're larger family offices and things of that nature, they all talk together and they're like, hey, so-and-so has a deal going on over here. He's got room for like a $10 million slug. Do you guys want it? And that's kind of how it happens.
Andy, I'd like to hear your version of raising capital for build to rent. And also part two of the question would be, did you hear anything about raising capital for build to rent at the conference?
Yeah, well, I think I'll answer the second one first. I think that there is a lot of lenders there that kind of fit in the space of maybe that second tranche. So typically how we would do a deal is we would go to a senior lender, right? And maybe on previous deals, they'd get us up to about 75, 80% loan to cost. And then we would need to either raise all of that additional capital equity through retail investors, LPs, and the cost of that capital could be pretty expensive, right? If you're doing a 70-30 split and you got a waterfall and you're paying them quite a bit in return. But I think there's this group that's starting to come out of this kind of second tranche, which is usually private equity, usually backed by, you know, smaller family offices. And they'll take you from that 75% up to maybe that 90%, 85 to 90% loan to cost. And they'll charge you anywhere between, you know, 10 to 15% for that equity. But they'll really want the sponsor, us, to be well capitalized, they'll really, they'll big on the track record. They're big on the liquidity because the collateral that they want is usually two times the amount of the equity that they're investing. So let's just say it's a, $32 million deal. They're going to want to have $6 million in collateralized kind of a modified recourse for that equity. And then we'd have to raise the additional 10% or so from our LP investors. And that's kind of where your, relationships obviously come in, because we can get, our buddies in there to kind of, hey, let's get the rest of this stack done with $3 million or whatever. We can usually raise that pretty quickly. So I'm seeing a lot of kind of creative structures, but I think what people really are honing in on is track record, even more so than before, liquidity, even more so than before. And, that collateral piece is big.
Cool. Chris is curious, any tips on finding the right family office? My partner, Richard C. Wilson of the Capital Raiser Show, he owns 50% of the show now and handles all my video production. He's got a great company and he does a bunch of conferences. I can actually hook you up with tickets sometimes, depending on what city you're in and what event you want to go to. Being a partner of his has his perks, right? So I get my friends free tickets at these different events. Like actually tonight, I'm jumping on a plane to New York City. Tomorrow I'll be at a family office event in NYC. So that should be really cool. But reach out to me or go to familyoffices.com to see if you can get in with that circle. He's got a great, great circle. I'll actually put in a link there. The other thing that I wanted to say on the capital raising side, for any of the guys that are in here or ladies, but for those of you guys that are doing build to rent at a very small scale, Gunta, I talked to you just a couple of days ago. I met with somebody yesterday that has a construction debt fund specifically for guys in your kind of phase of development that are like, 1 to 20 units and houses. So, and his name is Edward Brown. Anybody that wants his contact information, email me Ruben@legacyacquisitions.com. Or, send me a private message here through the chat. So let's go into the understanding the different time frames of a development. For each phase, how long does this take? Is it, longer in certain cities or, let's kind of talk about this a little bit. Do you want to take this, yeah, Ray? Or
sure. I mean, and I'll let Andy kind of, please, correct me if anything is much different for you, so everybody can kind of hear it from both of us at the same time. But pretty much if I grab unentitled land and it's less than 50 acres, which means it's not going to have to go. Let me back up. If it's a smooth process, it's an 18-month process for the zoning and entitlement. That's pretty much it. That's not counting your building permits and all that kind of stuff. That might take a little bit longer, but 18 months and you're not going to have another vote or anything like that. And you can usually convince somebody to come in. How that changes that's 18 months to get the shovel ready. How that changes is when you have to do any type of comp plan amendment, meaning you're going outside the future land use. Here in the state of Florida, it used to be, I think it was 20 acres about 2 years ago. That would make it, that was your delineation line between large scale comp plan and small scale. They just bumped that up to 50. So that's really great. Like I have a project that's 56 acres, but I'm actually assembling three parcels. So I did my zoning in two separate tranches. So a 40 acre and a 16 acre, and then I brought them together afterwards. So I didn't have to transmit them to the state because they were over 50 acres. If you transmit them to the state, they got to go to DEO and it's this whole process. And anyway, so it's in a simple scenario, it's 18 months to get to where you're applying for your building permits, you're finalizing your architecture, and then you're shovel ready. So call it 18 to 20 months, something like that. And then from there, it depends on the product you're building and how large your project is. But I've never seen a build get completed in less than an additional 18 months. So call it 36 months if you're like flying as fast as possible with no issues. But in today's world, I mean, call it 20 to 24 months for the build. And again, my builds are a little bit bigger, so that could totally be different. This is for like a 200 plus unit community. It could be totally different, like 100 units or something like that. I think you'd actually hit that 18 month mark. So all in all, you're at 36 to like 48 months before you're going to be leased up and stabilized. So, that's why you have that 3 to 5 year timeline in real estate. And certainly doing build to rent is not, it's funny. If you have a production builder that's been doing thousands of homes, like back in 05 and 06 before everything blew up, they can build homes really, really quick. But I don't think that the America today in the building world has enough of those national or regional fee builders that can actually crank out units the way that we've seen in previous years. And I think with the supply chain now, it's just, it's pretty inefficient when you compare it to multifamily, to be honest with you. But that's the thing that always irks me is I love build to rent and everything, but whenever I look at a project as a build to rent project and I look at it as a multifamily project, I'm like, why am I doing this? But then you look at the different ways to exit and the appreciation and the story gets a lot brighter. So call it 36 to 48 months for a project from beginning, putting it under contract to bringing it to a tenant.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, Ruben. So when we started, you know, we were doing stuff in California and obviously we would just
brave people.
Yeah, no, we would know like what Ray said is that's crazy, right? We'd be like, come on, Ray, sound a little bit crazy here with the speed with which you can build things. But then we went to the Southeast and, you know, when we met Hammerhead, you know, they're building stuff so quickly there. Part of the reason is because it's the same materials, right? So we're building 3 2 bedrooms in our Lafayette project, almost all of them the same layout with different elevations. So we can kind of speed through the build process. I think our underwriting is probably like 6 per month, but we're probably a little closer to 8 per month. And then Foley, Alabama, we can build a little bit faster. That's a 155 unit. So we're going to be building those a little bit faster. But I think that's right. The phases of getting the entitlements done and the speed with which you can move through these municipalities, you know, in Venice Beach, we had maybe the toughest neighborhood council in the country, right? So they're not like, talk about NIMBY, like that's never, ever going to happen in their backyard. So building in areas like that is nearly impossible. I think that they're trying to ease that a little bit. Maybe we'll be back in California at some point in the future. But in the Southeast, I think we can build a lot faster. And that's part of the reason in this game now, Ruben, you know, especially where interest rates are, the speed with which you can get these things done now is critical. And so these efficiencies we've seen potentially in some areas, and again, it's localized, but in our area, you know, the cost of labor's come down a little bit. Concrete's gone up, lumber's come down since where we were. And so we just kind of have to monitor all those things so that we can be as efficient as possible, because this getting it stabilized quicker, that's where the investors are going to make their money.
All right, let's chop it up about exit strategies. Do you want to sell to individual retail buyers? Do you want to sell to institutions? Who do you want to sell to and why?
Andy, you want me to go first?
Yeah, take that, Ray. And then I'm sure that there's probably some questions. I noticed a lot of kind of BTR.
Yeah, we'll have to go quick on the answer for this.
Yeah. So just to be real quick, I always try and keep everything super simple. So if I'm in a market where it was hard to get the institution there in the first place, it's most likely going to be pretty hard to sell them the asset afterwards, unless you really do prove out your thesis. And they're like, you know, it's hard to get those people to say, oh, we were wrong, now we'll pay top dollar for it. If it's in a market where you're able to convince, or where I was able to convince a co-GP that has some cachet and a lot of capital, then I know we're going to exit as a single community to a large institution at hopefully a sub 5 cap, or in today's market, probably sub 5.25. As far as like, if I were in a community with a smaller, say I only had like 125 unit community or something like that, and I didn't go crazy on the amenities, when you're going to the institutions, you have to be highly amenitized, all that kind of stuff. They're going to be bringing Wall Street people to come kick the tires. They, you know, you really have to convince them that you're a differentiator and something that will be a long-term hold for them, because they'll probably chop it up and sell it off behind the purchase. Going to a different type of community where it's 125 units, maybe just a pool or a tennis court, nothing crazy, you know, like big clubhouse or anything, then that's something where I think you'd get a way better yield selling like 5 and 10 packs to mom and pop investors, what I call Main Street. So I would sell to Main Street if I had a less amenitized, lower density or just lower unit count in a more tertiary or secondary market. But if I don't have that and I have something that's a little bit more flashy, highly amenitized, you put a lot of work into it, then I want to exit as one big tranche, because it's nothing, it can get weird. And you should probably talk to a debt guy about this, but it can get weird when you're paying down your loan and you're losing NOI at the same time. I'm not the best at math here. I got guys on my team who are, so you just have to be careful whenever you're exiting as packs, as I call them, just because, you know, you may end up selling the ones with the highest NOI or the highest return first, just because you're trying to set a high bar and not have a low first sale in your community. Because if you sell something higher, obviously the idea is to keep stepping up, stepping up, stepping it up. But if you do that, you may lose your cash cows. And all of a sudden you find yourself when you're at like 50% ownership of the community, actually struggling to keep your DSCR of over one and a quarter, and you're going to get your loan called. So anyway, Andy can kind of tag on to all that.
No, I think you nailed it, Ruben. I think we should get the questions. The one thing I would just add, so on some projects, we're doing exactly what Ray said, where we kind of, you know, just each one is individually platted so that we can do those 5 and 10 to mom and pop. And other scenarios, Foley, Alabama, for instance, it's one community, right? One subdivision. Now, ultimately, we could individualize those units, but then we have to create an HOA, and then we'd have to cut them down. So I think you're right. Going in, you kind of figure out what is the best story for this particular project and who is ultimately the best buyer for that. That's part of the draw of development, is that you do have that ability to sell in 5 or 10 or keep some of them, wait until the market changes, and then just collect your cash flow in between. Well, go ahead, Ruben.
No, let's open it up for questions. So first one actually is in the chat from Thomas. He's curious if there's any other build to rent conferences coming up that you guys know about.
An IMN guy, so I just sign up to their stuff and they send me. I think they have a conference every 5 days, it seems like. So
I think there's one in Nashville coming up.
So. And they're not all built to rent though. They can be cannabis.
You're right. They tell the next build to rent one that's on my radar is in Arizona in December, if I recall correctly, off the top of mind, but don't quote me.
Okay, great. I'll be there.
All right, so it's open up. Come off mute if you have questions, regardless of what your stage is at in the built-to-rent space. If you got questions, now is the time to ask Andy and Ray. Yeah, carte blanche.
Yeah, is there any good references for learning more about this kind of stuff? Do you guys have any good reference material so I can read more on this?
Yeah, legacyacquisitions.com. I think we got a lot of stuff. Ruben's been putting together quite a bit. But I would say there's a lot of, it's going to be kind of like that car that you're ready to buy. Now you'll see it everywhere. So when you get online, you're going to see BTR all over the place and just kind of learning about it. And then I've got a couple of development books that we could recommend that we'll put them in the, I don't know, is there going to be show notes for this one, Ruben? Is this going to be a pod or?
So if you're talking about the book that you sent me, I can put that into the,
I don't remember.
Into the YouTube video and also.
If you're not having trouble sleeping, it's probably.
Yeah. That's funny. Some good people to learn from would definitely be the SVN SFR capital management guys, Jeff Klein, Jay Parsons, and then Brad Hunter. They're like your data nerds. They'll tell you everything about the market, all that kind of stuff. And then if you really want to learn about the debt market, get on the phone with a debt broker. And if you really want to learn about the equity market, get on the phone with an equity broker. You'll never learn better than that. In addition to that, do exactly what Andy said. Go to all the guys and gals who are doing it already. A group that I didn't know about that I learned about is called Advenir Oakley. It's a very different name. It's not so, but anyway, they have a great website and they're a competitor of mine. So this is, I'm happy to pat them on the back. They did a great job of laying out why BTR is awesome and, the sound thesis and the theme behind it. Yeah. So that's exactly how I handle everything. It's the people who are out there doing it that know it best. They're the ones getting, punched in the nose every time they're trying to do something and they don't forget why. And you take those lessons.
Yeah, Brody, if you want to learn about built to rent, I would hang out at these webinars. We're going to be doing quite a bit on specifically built to rent. I also put in a link to a Neil Bawa webinar that he did on YouTube where he's just kind of breaking down built to rent. So I'd check that out as well. Anybody else got a question here? We got a few more minutes.
Yeah, so I saw a comment of Ray. If you wouldn't mind just putting some of those names in, Jeff Klein, Hunter.
Oh, I gotcha. Here,
because there's a good list that we could create. That's pretty compelling. I was talking to Walker Dunlop guys. They've got a lot of
watch out. They're gonna want exclusivity. So
yeah, that's true. There was another question on there.
What was that? I put them in there. And then Advenir Oakley actually has two websites. So
one thing that you guys should know is there is incredible demand from, maybe I should put up this slide. No, I won't. If anybody's curious, I have a slide of all of the institutions and banks and funds and hedge funds and REITs. And what I've heard from Neil Bawa, actually in that video, you'll see him pull up this slide. So maybe you guys can pull it from there. But he's talking about APH, JP Morgan, and these guys that have billions and billions of dollars. He mentioned that there's probably about $500 billion worth of funds looking for build-to-rent subdivision product across the country. And developers like myself, Andy, and Ray can only provide these institutions like 2% of what they have money deployed and ready to buy. So it's driving down the cap rates for build-to-rent projects significantly, where Neil Bowie even says, you know, like in multifamily, you might find low caps in some markets and in the low fours. And he was selling some stuff at 3.25% cap rate. So it's pretty ridiculous, you know, what this demand from institutional buyers can do for investors in this space. Go ahead.
Just a quick note on that. I have a friend of mine that went into an area called Kannapolis, North Carolina. Most people have never heard of it. Not Annapolis, Maryland, but Kannapolis, North Carolina. I think the rents were at like $1.40 a square foot when he went in there. They're now over $2. And he was the first recorded sub four cap trade in the area. So you're totally right. And it was just because he told a great story. He did a bunch of P3 stuff. And my point is Goldman Sachs were the people who went in with him. And all of a sudden the cap rates, all of a sudden went from 6 to like 3.9, 4.2, all that kind of stuff. And the math works when you can move, you can literally make a market when you have that type of capital and they'd have such low supply. So that's kind of what I hope. I'm blessed enough to be able to say that kind of stuff about the areas like Ocala and Wildwood that I operate in and Cocoa. Anyway, that's like the dream. You get a big institution to a place that hasn't, that's untapped, and then they change the landscape with you. And you're the guy or gal that's pushed cap rates down for everybody. You know, you saw around corners, but it's kind of crazy.
Well, Ruben, I think the part of the reason there's so many people on this call today is, you know, in talking to Adam Stern, who we had on our webinar at the conference, you know, he's with Strata. That's another great resource, Strata SFR. He would say that we're probably in the end of the first inning at this point. Now, that might sound crazy, but think about this. If Wall Street basically has 50% of the multifamily market right now, they only have 2% of the built to rent market. Most of it is mom and pop. So the American Homes for Rent, the larger institutional guys, they still have so much left to be building and buying and controlling as built to rent. So this is really the early stages. And I think that's part of the reason there's so much interest in it and why I'm seeing so many multifamily guys start to come over on this side of the, this side of the,
everybody's chasing yield.
That's right. That's right.
Cool. Any last words of wisdom for the aspiring capital raiser and or built to rent syndicator on their journey as they're scaling? Either of those.
Don't overpay and do your best to get into an A location and then find a guy or gal who can help you ride the storm and you'll be okay.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say is find your one connection away. And if you really want to understand this thing, just start getting on the phone with people and pick their brain. And that includes brokers, includes lenders, includes private equity guys, developers. And I think you'll start to triangulate. This will come into focus as to, you know, the power of these markets and the power of built to rent in general.
Crazy. It just goes to show built to rent is really sexy right now. There's like 30 people on this call for the listeners that are tuning in on the Capital Raiser show. It's crazy how many people we got on here. So thanks everybody. If you have additional questions, Ray, how do they reach out to you?
Yeah. So I'm one of those crazy guys who put his cell phone on his website. You can call and text me if you need to, or my email is ray@southernwaterscapital.com. And obviously my domain is southernwaterscapital.com as well. So reach out. And if you abuse my phone number, I will block you. Just like
hilarious. Rock and roll. This has been a blast. Anybody that wants to reach out to myself or Andy, you can find us at legacyacquisitions.com. This has been really fun and entertaining and very educational. Thank you very much, guys. And for the audience, thank you so much for coming to these webinars. It really means a lot to us and adds a great deal to the energy. So with that, I'm going to bless you guys and, you know, wish you a wonderful day. And we'll talk to you guys on the next one. Peace and strength, my friends.
Thank you. Thanks, Ruben. Good seeing you, Ray.
Legacy Acquisitions.